Welcome to Build Repeat, a Paces podcast. Hello, today we're speaking with Carson Wynant, Senior Product Developer at CVE. Welcome to the podcast, Carson.
Yeah. Hi, James. Thanks for having me.
Brian, to start with, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you ended up at CVE?
Sure. Yeah. So first of all, I want to say thanks for having me again. Been cool getting to know you over the past 9 months. And congratulations on everything you've done with Paces. So I think it's super impressive what you've built from scratch. I've seen you hustling extremely hard nonstop. And you guys have built a very powerful product so that we love using at CVE. So we're a customer of Paces.
That is incredibly nice that you mentioned. And yeah, I mean, just because you mentioned it for the audience, I was myself and co-founder at Paces, Charles, we were ideating on what became Paces. And I think I cold messaged you, Carson, 9-12 months ago, and just was like, hey, what's your product developer? We're kind of thinking through what eventually became Paces. And you had like a really positive impact in terms of like just telling us all the kind of problems that you had experienced in the various roles you've had in the solar industry. And so that was like, people who take the time to like really tell folks who are trying to start something their problems is just like super powerful and very, very appreciated.
Yeah, it's great. It's fun to be a part of it. I wanted to help. But your level of execution is really impressive. And I also wanted to help because, I had a similar platform that I tried to build, I guess it was in like 2016, 2017. It was called Property Owl. It was a web-based GIS mapping application, aimed at helping developers find the best sites more quickly. And I think I was a little naive, a little green at the time, not set up for success, but learned a ton. We were able to launch, I guess, like a version 1.0 of the product. Eventually had to shut it down, but it's cool to see somebody take the same idea all the way through and have success with it. So,
and honestly, you were talking to us about Property Owl at the time, and we were kind of, I remember the early conversations we were having, and I guess like to kind of go back to that, what do you think, I guess, were some of the trade-offs and some of the reasons why sometimes things like this work and sometimes they don't?
Yeah, so I got the idea. I was a solar site originator working in Massachusetts for the SREC 2 program at the time in 2013, 14, 15. That was my first job out of college. And Massachusetts at the time had one of the best state-run GIS mapping resources available. It was called Oliver. I don't know what they've done with it since, but that's sort of where I fell in love with GIS and saw the power of GIS, found saw how useful and necessary it was for finding good sites quickly. And the core idea was, there's a ton of wetlands in Massachusetts. The core idea was, if I could filter by parcels based on percentage wetlands, I could get to the good sites a lot more quickly. And it grew and grew from there. And I took a big leap of faith with the little savings that I had. Very confident in myself at the time. I didn't know how to code. And worked with some freelance developers to try to put a platform together. And for looking back with the resources I had, we actually did a pretty darn good job. But also looking back, wasn't really set up for success. So, I didn't quite know. I was young. I was 25, 26. Didn't quite know how to set up a team around me. Didn't quite know how to recruit people that had the skills I needed. Didn't quite have enough capital. I didn't know how to code myself. And ultimately, when we launched, the product just wasn't quite good enough to actually make a sale. And I ran out of money and ran out of energy and had to move on, unfortunately.
So I had an identical situation with a previous startup attempt. So in 20, and probably around the same time period, so 2015, 2016, she started a startup in the fitness space with my brother. And we spent 6 months using outside engineering contractors to build the V1. It was basically kind of like an Uber for personal training, right? So find a person using an app. And my brother's kind of well-regarded personal trainer, so he knew the industry very, very well. And I'd worked in software, but never on the product side before. And so that was like, we're, it's a great pair of brothers. We're going to figure this out. And, we made a very, I think it is, a lot of folks will make the very common mistake, which is outsourcing the product development from a coding point of view. And you can definitely get to an MVP. And so we did get to an MVP, wasn't really used. And then we ended up adding a third co-founder who was a software engineer, Peter, who was an incredible software engineer. But he had to literally start from scratch. Like, he couldn't even work off the thing. So the thing we had worked a little bit, and it kind of sounds somewhat similar to the stage you got with Property Owl. But we also ended up in the situation, and we were bootstrapping as well. We ran out of money, worked on it for just over a year, and learned a lot. But I think as much of what we learned to do, we also learned what not to do. And I think a lot of those lessons impacted how I kind of think about paces and all the different things we're trying to do.
Yeah, when you outsource that key work, you can't iterate quickly. You can't, your ideas don't translate perfectly. Every change is very expensive. It's not the way to set up a startup.
And because you've had that experience, and I'm going to move this conversation a little bit more, kind of more freewheeling, because I think we have that relationship. But where do you think, and forget Paces, right? Forget any other software out there. You've worked on something that you built it. You're in the industry. You are looking at sites. You're trying to get projects built. What does like perfect look like? You know, if there was like unlimited capital and unlimited resources to build some sort of software, maybe there's hardware involved, you know, whatever it might be. What are some of the areas that like, there's just, no one's really solving the problem to the degree that could be possible?
Yeah. Some of the key data that you need, such as zoning designation and interconnection viability, is just very difficult to get. It's very manual. It's stuck in these old world institutions. It's not digitalized. So you end up having to manually reach out. For zoning, you have to call the planning department, you have to ask questions, you have to share the property tax ID, you have to review the zoning code. That takes time. You have to do that site by site. For interconnection, if you're lucky, you have a state like New York where there's continuously updated hosting capacity maps that show you the number of projects that are in queue, the capacity of the substation, the voltage of the feeder. You can get a really good sense, you know, within 5 minutes of whether or not your project can connect to the grid. But in most other states, you have to submit and pay, you know, maybe $300-$500 for a pre-application report that takes 2 weeks to get back. And there's no consistency across utilities, across states, in what information they give back to you. It's really hit or miss. Those pre-application reports aren't crystal clear. So if you could build a platform that somehow solves these structural information gaps, if we're talking ideal world, that would be it.
So one thing that we've been thinking about is, can we, and the we, not just Paces, but like as an industry and so on, can we like do a better job of actually like naming and shaming where the truly opaque gaps are? Now, I think at the level of the utility, that might not work as well with the interconnection side of things, because all the folks on the utility side or at the ISO or RTO level have been told many, many times of these issues and kind of have to work through various systems to try to like get change. And it's a half a decade or multi-decade process. So those things, I think I've different ideas on that, but I'd love to get your take on that in a second. But on the jurisdictional side for zoning and permitting on the AHA side, you know, one of the things we've been thinking about is if you have like 1,000 townships in New York State, and there are a few of these towns and villages, and maybe they're not even anti-solar, right? Like they might not have the internal capability to manage like a lot of solar applications, all that kind of thing. But it's like really opaque about where the actual breakages are occurring, right? So like, you know, you have some sort of like state level like target of a certain number of gigawatts of solar deployed in a certain time frame. And then you look at the different jurisdictions, and like there are towns, as you and I both know, where solar goes to die, right? There's like 12 projects attempted there in the last 2 years. And there's a ton of capacity on the lines there. There's some nice flat land. Probably the landowners themselves are like super open to it. But, you know, it just can't get through the zoning and permitting steps. You know, one of the things we're thinking about is like, should we be surfacing and saying at the state level, it's like, hey, village A, B, and C is blocking like this very, very high proportion of solar. And not to just like say, oh, that they're bad or good or whatever it may be. It's more to just surface and it's like, okay, maybe there should be state legislation that now can say, okay, if we had something a bit more streamlined, we could push that down to the individual jurisdictions and then have like a bit of a theory of change around like less opaque, you know, less opaque data at the level of the jurisdiction. What are your thoughts on that as a potential approach?
Yeah, I think that would take a huge overhaul at the state level though. That would be great. You're sort of taking away local rights in that case. In New York, they call it home rule. And each locality is very proud of that, that they have full control over their zoning and what they allow into the town. I think New York State has attempted to do that with the utility scale projects. I know they have, you know, a few years ago, they introduced the Office of Renewable Energy Siting. I don't work on utility scale projects. I work on community solar projects that are 5, 6, 7 megawatts each. But it seems like that office had the goal of limiting the permitting process for utility scale projects to 12 months. Permitting is done at the state level. There's a streamlined process. The locality can only comment. They can't make the decision. I think something like that should be implemented in other states and maybe extended to community solar. That said, I was thinking about, you know, what are the major roadblocks for community solar before this podcast? And permitting is definitely one of them. I would say we probably have a 50-60% success rate for permitting at the local level. So it does kill some projects. But I think the real market killer for community solar is, one, just a community solar program existing and being large enough. And two, interconnection capacity and interconnection procedures. So a lot of states don't have community solar programs, or they have community solar programs that are very limited, like Virginia.
Arizona.
Only has Arizona, New Mexico. It's like, what are we doing here? The whole industry tries to squeeze in as well, and everybody ends up with a quarter of a project. That's what's so nice about New York. You know, they had a 6 gigawatt target. It was a multi-year thing. Everybody got a piece of the pie. You could actually build a business around it. It seems like that's what's going to happen in California as well, which is exciting. And then interconnection. A lot of these utilities are antiquated. They're slow. They process one application at a time. They have some very unfavorable terms for payment and refunds. There's no great communication with the utilities. There's no great transparency. So I see, you know, site conditions. You need a good site. You need good local zoning. But I think the real constraints for the industry, at least this middle market community solar, is state policy and interconnection rulemaking procedures. Yeah.
On the state policy side, because I know you're keeping across a lot of different states, is there enough communication happening between states, right? So like when Ohio is moving their community solar bill through their legislation, do you have any kind of visibility into, are they like looking at states where it's been more successful, like New York, or states where we've had, you know, recent setbacks, like in Arizona? Like, is there actually enough like cross-state like communication happening? And of course, like in any individual state, right, like it might just be, you know, the left-right makeup of that state might just block some of this anyways, right? It just might be the nature of local politics. Are they actually making it a fair attempt of learning from other communities and other states?
Yeah, I think some states are. I think, for example, California is trying to mirror New York in some senses. You know, they've modeled a first come, first serve program with a high capacity program. It's not 200 megawatts. You have to have permits. You have to have interconnection. And then you have to submit for that capacity. It's not an RFP like New Mexico, which was a mess. That said, it seems like New Mexico didn't learn from the other states. So I think there's some limitation as well. California is supposedly copying the VITR bill credit rate from New York, which is the rate that they compensate community solar projects at. And they're putting together a calculator for that, which is what New York did, which gives a lot of guidance to developers, and it really helps our financial modeling. But beyond that, I don't have too much to say. You know, I don't get involved too much in the state rulemaking.
So one of the things you mentioned is like, when, depending on the state rulemaking, like there might be a quarter of a project per developer. How do you think about like competition across developers, right? You know, you have, especially when there's like maybe limited opportunities. Obviously, everyone's like looking for a competitive edge and don't share like the specific IP of what you could work out. But more generally, what is the relationship? Because we're all, as an industry, again, trying to grow the pie. But then there are also these specific situations where there's a limited piece of the pie and individual developers are trying to get their cut. How do you think about those kind of competitive dynamics?
You have to be first. You have to be first in the queue. It helps to be first in front of the AHJ for permitting. You have to be first to secure the incentives. So you end up doing more and more work in states where there's not a program yet or where the interconnection queue isn't open yet. And you end up taking more and more risk in hopes that the market eventually comes together. So this is what we're doing with our pipeline in states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, and so on, where there's, you know, hope that a program will come together. And that's really the only way to maybe have a windfall of projects one day. It's one of the ways, is to really position yourself to be first. Because you end up, if you try to tackle a market a year after it's been announced, you're going to have a lot more difficulty with landowners. The interconnection queues are going to be clogged. Some of the AHJs may be fatigued with permitting applications. They may reject your application because three others have already been permitted in town. So you got to try to do as much before it's a mass market, before the floodgates really open.
And in essence, it is this kind of whack-a-mole approach, right? Because there's then some positive, you know, white smoke coming out of some jurisdiction. And then it's like, all right, let's everyone flood into state A, right? In terms of like trying to up some, you know, via mailer campaigns or whatever it might be. And then it's like, oh, there's now a setback and the bill won't be passed for an extra 6 months. So it's like, okay. And then it kind of cools off. And we see this as well. Like there's just like incredible activity around some states. And then we hear, it's so funny, like some developers are like 6 months later, like, oh, you know, have you heard about the state? And it's like, yeah, it's like some folks who are actually willing to bear more risk have potentially have already picked over like a lot of the, like the good bits 6 months before anybody else. And it's a real struggle, right? Because, and then you think about the landowner on often the farm or whatever it might be, like they're just getting these waves of like inbound, like interest, right? And, you know, until eventually they, you know, maybe give up and accept some site control and do like a multi-year lease option or whatever it might be.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, for example, one of our competitors, Dimension Energy, they were in Virginia in 2019. The bill was finalized in early 2020. CVE didn't react until maybe early 2021. And now Dimension is very successful in Virginia. They're taking most of the initial capacity in that program. So try to learn from that and hope that the positive momentum we have in the industry continues, that more states adopt this policy. We could do it more places. They have bigger megawatt targets. So
how do you think about some of the carrots? You know, you have the Inflation Reduction Act, you have these other tax credits, and because so much of project success is down to interconnection cost, how do you think about like weighing up, oh, you know, we might get this extra adder, and so there might have to be 80 yards of line upgrades, like three-phase line upgrades, but the substation's in good shape, so it might now pencil out in a way that it didn't before if we weren't in like an energy community.
Yeah, I think the IRA and the new set of rules for the ITC will certainly help build more projects. You know, some of those economically marginal projects will pencil. For example, you know, there's even possibility in New York of upgrading transformers. For projects 5 megawatt and under, all the interconnection costs are now eligible for the ITC. So maybe you can afford a $3 million transformer upgrade because it's subsidized at 30, 40, 50%. So it does open up new opportunities, and we're thankful for it.
I think about this with things like the prevailing wage as well. Like that's also a complicated step in the Inflation Reduction Act, where the purpose of the bill, right, is to get projects built in a certain way at scale, but also, you know, in ways that can help communities, all this kind of thing. But the actual translation of that text into like actions that developers are taking on the ground sometimes is kind of difficult, right? So like if you're trying to figure out for a given jurisdiction, so if I'm in an energy community and the transformer, you know, upgrading transformers might make sense, but then I have to also have a prevailing wage element to that. You know, you have all these different variables. And so I guess like has your, you know, internal modeling become much more complicated to kind of take into account all these different factors?
Sure. So with regards to the ITC adders, there's definitely a little gray area with how it'll shake out. You know, what can we actually claim at COD or when it's placed in service with our tax equity partner. I know they're finalizing the rules regarding the low-income economic benefit adder, which is potentially a 20% adder, which is massive. So it's a little frustrating right now when we look at our modeling where we don't know exactly what ITC rate we'll get. We also don't have 100% confidence in the energy communities layer. We have a really good guess, but that final layer coming from the EPA could shift. Projects could move in or out of the energy communities layer, and you could have a plus or minus 10% ITC swing. But generally, overall, it's helping projects. Regarding prevailing wage, though, I think that's a little bit more straightforward. And that's just coming from our EPC partners. You know, what does it cost to get a prevailing wage adder here? What does it cost to add prevailing wage to this installation? We're seeing maybe 10, 12 cents a watt. Not too bad.
Yeah, just on the energy community maps. So we're in literally daily contact with the DOE and Nettle, who manage that map. And so IRS guidance has been out like a week since June 1st, and it's June 9th now, 2023. For those listening, and some of these submissions are due June 30th, and others are on July 30th, or July 31st, and there's not actually the confirmed data. So there's going to be this mad rush, I think, across the industry once we get the final confirmation on the employment-based energy communities. We like managing all that data, though, right? So that's we're refreshing that data and figuring it out. I guess then just to kind of think through kind of work you do and so on, there's been a big change, I think, in terms of the appeal of renewable development, you know, the types of folks who are now looking at that as a potential career. Have you seen any, you know, changes? Who are you seeing, like a different type of person who's now wants to be involved in renewable development, especially in the last like 18 months?
It's definitely more mainstream. I don't really know what that means for the labor market, though. You know, I joined the solar industry in, like I said, 2013, 2014. It was definitely much more niche, at least for community solar. It was, or CNI solar was limited to just like New Jersey, Massachusetts. Now it's across the nation. It employs hundreds of thousands of people. We're deploying many more megawatts, but and more people know of it just day to day in my life. They know solar energy is a real industry, and they think it's a cause for good change. And they're excited to talk with me about it, which is pretty cool. It didn't used to be that way. But I don't know. Unfortunately, can't comment on, you know, what type of people this is attracting. It's pretty young, I'd say. You know, the CVE workforce is young and eager and excited.
100%. And Carson, it's been great chatting, great catching up.
Yeah.
Before I leave it off, is there anything I should have asked you about but did not?
No, I think I got my key point across that, you know, we need policy reform and interconnection reform to really unlock this industry.
Fully agree. We are fully aligned on that. Thank you, Carson.
Thanks, James. Good chatting with you.